And for a third and final presentation today, we're really glad to have Dr. Kelsey Sclair with us. And he is going to be talking about the plant heroes that saved our plant parents from being eaten by couch potatoes while their crop wild. Relatives watched. And so we turn the floor over to you.
Okay. Howdy, everybody.
So I have the wonderful experience of satisfying several things on my bucket list today. The first is that I'm here between you and cocktails at the lovely Tropicana Resort Hotel. And so, you know, I'm playing Vegas for the first time, and it's just a thrill. The second is that, and this might only relate to those of you guys who are under 35, but I've always wanted to use Showcard Gothic font in a presentation for a professional audience, and I'm getting to satisfy both of those today. My talk really just sort of brings everything together. There's a lot of experiential learning. It's kind of a smorgasbord approach. I have data. I have some numbers in here. We'll have it shared with you, but really the idea is just to kind of sit back, watch, and experience sort of all the different ways that our public gardens connect and connect with people. And I've told you a little bit about myself. I'm a proud member of the Advisory Council for Seed Your Future, which is trying to engage the next generation of plant parents, and we'll talk about that. I also work with the National Initiative of Consumer Horticulture as its inaugural chair, and then for the past 8 years I've been privileged to be the executive director of the American Public Gardens Association. And some of you guys are saying, well, what is the American Public Gardens Association? So simply put, this is our vision for the American Public Gardens Association, and this is our mission and our vision. We believe in a world where public gardens are indispensable and that they're there and accessible and that nature's accessible for all audiences. Who are we? A little bit about who we are and a little bit behind the numbers. Public gardening and the public garden sector is a $2.3 billion a year revenue industry, so it's not a small one, but it's a part of something much, much bigger. And we're the Professional Membership Association. We're the sister association to ASHS. And we connect, protect, and champion our members and all our gardens throughout the USA, Canada, Mexico, and about 20 other countries. And we get a lot of people. So our statistics show that about 1 in 6 people in a 25-mile geographic radius to our gardens has been there. That equates to about 121 million visitors a year. That is roughly a little over 90% of all major professional sports league attendance combined. NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, and hockey. They're at about 132, and we're at about 120, and we're going to catch them someday. Thanks to HDTV, we are on the rise. But really, what are some of the experiences that we see that are engaging all audiences in all ages? First of all, it's a movement in nature connection that was started by the very now famous book, Last Child in the Woods, about having nature experiences by Richard Louv. And our gardens are places where people can sort of disconnect from the digital world and reconnect with the sacred beauty of a garden. And you all know about disconnecting this week because you've had trouble with Wi-Fi, right? And think about how much that's made you crave a nature experience. Our world is the agriculture that 98% of Americans engage in on a daily basis. And so we really have something to offer, and there's lots to offer anywhere you go, even in Las Vegas. I've seen turf and I've seen landscape plants. But recently, this has been moving into two different directions that I see. The first, signified here in the lower left-hand corner, really has to do with the urban forest and urban canopy and the world that we live in and interact. And I'm not expecting you to read the fine print here, but it's just bragging about Atlanta being a city in the forest and having great urban tree canopy. And we think about all the utility and services that the urban forest provides. And then the second part is about Nature RX and prescriptions for nature, and how there's now a book out by Don Rakow from Cornell University called Nature RX that they've developed, where university healthcare professors write nature prescriptions for their students. And forest bathing is popular in Japan. And so we're moving into a world where people are getting pushed into nature instead of just finding it on their own. And that's another thing that we're finding. The plant parent generation, right, gravitates toward it, but not without immersion. And we feel that public gardens offer that. We also offer gateways in with food and experiences with food that are very important. One of our words that we came up with is edible. And I think that that's very true, whether it's selling and having CSAs and farmers markets right there at the garden, or developing high-end cuisine and having a variety of experiences. So if you're thinking about being welcoming and people are being hungry and they need some hummus, maybe they also need some training and some education in humus and other things. And then, of course, the integration of alcohol. So everybody gets to be over 21, even millennials and Gen Z eventually. And so at that point, they always think about different things. And it can be education with snappy titles, such as my friends from Santa Barbara Botanic Garden, one of my home gardens, and doing that. But then they make this an experiential learning opportunity. So here they're taking the educational approach at UC Berkeley and flipping it in with a movie night. So we'll teach you how to make your own bitters. But at the same time, we will work on a broader educational opportunity with, say, here at Idaho Botanic Garden, they partner with the Sierra Club and do a film series and then have bitters and other cocktails in the garden. So that integration of the holistic experience and integrating all your senses into that experience, taste, touch, smell, everything helps you do that. And that's where this sort of experience kind of comes in and comes to the fore. Our gardens are very big now on art and exhibitions. It's a big movement within our garden world to develop exhibitions around different themes. It can be artists like Chipungu here at Fairchild Tropical Botanical Garden, or the very famous Roberto Burle Marx exhibit at Naples Botanic Garden, and transforming that experience and captivating all your senses at different moments in time, not just the, hey, let's go to the garden in the daytime, but let's come out at night and experience the garden at sunset or at night and have a moment and have an experience there as part of that. Two great federal examples of that right now. Smithsonian Gardens has created a unified experience throughout all the museums and all the gardens this summer called Habitat, and it gets into looking at all different habitats, protecting pollinators, protecting everybody in that nature immersion perspective right there in downtown DC on the Mall. And the U.S. Botanic Garden has also taken it to look at different public gardens and gardens across America, and they have an outdoor exhibit that you can wander through with different gardens from different areas of the country, not just Pennsylvania or the Mid-Atlantic region, but also ones from the Southwest, ones from the Northeast, ones from Florida, and different experiences so people can see all the different realms of gardens and how they intersect and interact. And I think that's kind of a key just moment and pause, and I think Jordan said it best. You know, this generation is much more diverse than all its previous generations, and they're much more interested in interconnecting in a very authentic fashion. And so it's not just, hey, you know, we cater to diverse people. It's more about really truly honoring that, whether it's making sure that we are blending together the, you know, science-based and conservation-based aspects, if we're paying homage to the people whose soil that we have the privilege of walking on every day here in America, in the indigenous cultures. It's doing whatever it is you're doing very authentically and not just trying to check a box. If you're going to do it deeply and do it all the way. This is our American Public Gardens Association Diversity and Inclusion Policy Statement. We're very serious about it. Our theme for our conference this year was Thrive Together, Diversity Grows Gardens. You can see all that on our website. But when you really look at how that comes to life in a garden, this is the Fort Worth Botanic Gardens Fall Festival. Can you see all the different types, ages, people, backgrounds of people? I mean, there's even a big guy in a coat and tie like me, white guy in a coat and tie, but there's really everybody there, including mobility impaired people, elderly, young, everybody comes together, and that garden is accessible. It's a place of relevance. It's a place of constance. And so that's what our public gardens, I think, represent the best of and get at the best of. Yes, we do all kinds of performances. We bring in community groups and have them perform here for us, so they're a place for performance, but also can have extremely just a few people at Charita's Garden in 2013 for the summer concert series. Do you remember what concert that was?
No.
You don't want to. So just a few people come to the garden for concert series. As a matter of fact, my wife and I are going to a concert in Atlanta Botanic Garden on Friday night just because they're there. Now, it's not being afraid to take risks when you're in a garden environment too. So sometimes you get cross hybridizations and they're supreme successes. So Myriad Botanical Gardens in Oklahoma City has Cat Video Fest in the garden, and it works. And why does it work for them? Because, as we'll see later, we have a lot of cross data to show that people who like cats also like to go and visit gardens. And we'll talk talk about why that is and where maybe we've seen some of that data and how some of the motivated gardens are using that. But I especially like this aspect of authenticity that's in this particular spot. So if you read what's outlined in the box here, it says, it is the best cat videos culled from countless hours of unique submissions. That's great, but Cat Video Fest is a joyous communal experience. Remember what Jordan said, okay? Only at select venues, so we use an air of exclusivity or importance or a thing that you can't get anyplace else, and it raises awareness for cats in need through partnerships with local cat charities, animal welfare organizations. So it's doing something good. So the combination of things is really important as an ingredient for success. Then we go out and we get a little bit further into the workplace. And we can do team building exercises at the gardens and we can hit people where they live because, of course, as you all know, horticulture is an occupation, it's a profession. But when you really think about it, it's a privilege to work with it in our field. My field in public gardens is not all horticulture. I love horticulture, it's my background, but together we're a piece of something much, 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 much bigger. And that's what I try to promote with the National Initiative of Consumer Horticulture when I'm talking to people and I'm advocating, is it is an almost a $200 billion a year, 2 million job industry. So it is not small. It's actually huge. The only difference is that we don't have a crop. We have a service. And that's why I use language like it's 98% of the agriculture that Americans see every day. We are the crop that Americans see every day and interact with. So we're the environment. Little bit of Seed Your Future. You're probably getting inundated with it this week, so Susan Yoder's with us, but I really like the two different things that are happening with Bloom and different graphics that are appealing to those younger audiences. And remember that a lot of people in traditional gardening statistics show that when our millennials begin to have their first kids or buy their first house, that's when they start to care even more about that experience. So I know that you have your new campaign that's out, and I'm sure you'll get a chance. If you don't know Susan, you really should, because she's doing something very special. My other point is that in the public garden world, it's not just the people who are direct horticulturists. Actually, only about 28% of the people who work for our public gardens are horticulturists. The rest are marketing people and a whole bunch of other backgrounds, development, administration, finance, HR, marketing, and communication. I'd like to take you from here into a little bit of a different realm. I did promise you Plant Heroes, so I'm going to show you some Plant Heroes. This is our Plant Heroes program. That's part of an overall plant protection program that we have that's targeted at youth education. So these are the plant heroes, Nate, Aponi, Laura, and Frankie. And they are our education that's targeted mainly at K-12 audiences on the importance of invasive species, invasive pests and diseases. And it's sponsored by the Forest Service. I'm just going to roll through these slides and show you guys a little bit of what the program does. We have a whole bunch of different villains that we've used. We added sidekicks to this, so it's really more of an experiential learning opportunity. If you want to learn more, there's the website. But we are trying to teach through storytelling. We're not trying to drive this at them. We're trying to give them examples that they can tap into. Obviously, you've got to go print and online materials as well, because that's very important. But we also use comic strips and a whole bunch of different other materials, activity books, field guides, and make it so that people can come out in the garden and can learn and can apply that knowledge and apply that learning. Two things that we're doing that I'll spotlight here in the future. The first is to translate our materials into Spanish, and then also talking about what we can do to make things better rather than whose fault it is that there's a problem. And so those are the two things that I would say to that. Technology is really important in our garden world. So here is Kedar, and he created his own app. And you're saying, how does a 9-year-old do that? Well, when your mother is a marketer and your father is a computer scientist, you can do that. But Kedar is a very special guy, and he created how to make a pollinator garden. And it's been very influential in our Million Pollinator Garden Challenge. The next thing I want to leave you with, and we're just going to wrap up here, is Plant Snap. So PlantSnap is your ability to explore citizen science, and it's part of a partnership that's burgeoning for us at the American Public Gardens Association. I want to draw your attention to PlantSnap's mission. We want to recreate the connection between people and the amazing natural world around us. And I bring that to your attention for a couple of reasons. It's a capability for citizen science that's just absolutely incredible. So as a best-of-class plant identification app that's powered by AI technology, it's been downloaded by millions of people. There's about 350,000 plant identification attempts that take place through PlantSnap every day. And is it going to replace horticulturists and botanists? No. The number one plant that they snap every day is rose. Can you imagine? And cultivars and trademarks of rose, you can forget about it. But what it can do is it can link people to crop plants and link people to the importance of food. This is a slide from some of our partnership that we have that Charta knows more about that we did about crop wild relatives and public gardens being a place for that. If you think about the very, very few crops that we all rely on for food and what the relatives of those that we're dependent on, it's very, very important. And everybody thinks, well, all these things are off in Persia or Asia or Eurasia or someplace, you know, that's not near here. U.S. number three in crop wild relatives. The darker area is a density gradient, so darker color on the left in that map. Those are markers where our botanic gardens are. Those are markers, the darker colors, where crop wild relatives are. They're in suburban areas. They're in urban areas. They're right around us. And PlantSnap can help you do that because it uses really specific location data. And so even if you download the app and you walk around out here, people are snapping right here, and they're taking pictures of plants right here, and they want to share that experience. So it's excellent for being able for people to know roughly what the plant is that's near them, learn more about that plant. It's incredible. And for us, it works because it also lists all of our different gardens. And I think that's important, too, because as you see here with the green arrow, there's more snaps happening at the public garden in general than is going on in that local community surrounding them. So people are already using this, and this is why our members are getting very interested in this, and we think that we have a good thing going on with that. The last piece that I want to leave you with, and then I think we can open up for discussion, is actually kind of a little bit of a dark web kind of thing. So I use show card gothic, and I'm going to end on a scary part. Okay. So social code is, how many of you guys have ever heard of social code and know what it is? So Susan, yeah, figures. All right, so social code is essentially, it's the technology that, say, Amazon and other large retail providers use. It's why that you can go and say, go to Walmart and say, nah, I'm going to look at dehumidifiers today. And then you go home, and it shows up on your Facebook page and ads and everything else. It finds out, in general, who you are, what you're interested in, what you do, where you've been, and where you're going. And it does it all through your phone because it knows where you've been walking around. It knows where you've been walking around in the store. PlantSnap shares a lot of data with social code and gleans a lot of data from social code. So we can find out for our gardens where you've been in the garden, what snaps you've attempted to take, what things you saw, when you saw it, and that'll help us understand how to do better educational interpretation for you. It'll help us protect our plants better, and it can help us all in the future. But giving you some of the little scary things to think about, my question to you is, how might you guys, as extension agents and researchers in horticulture and horticulture science, use technology like this to your advantage? So that's where we get a little provocative. Thank you very much.
All right. So that's the conclusion of our formal presentations for this afternoon, and that kind of segues in to our next discussion period. And I think that before we get started into some of the integrative concepts, and Casey's going to help, and Esther and Sherida were kind of going to team lead this, I wanted to kind of open the floor for any remaining questions for our speakers before we jump into more discussion. Mm-hmm.
question.
I wanted to ask a question of you. There was so much information about signage and where the eyeballs were popping around. I can see some huge advantages to having a sign in the pot as opposed to a sign above from a retail point of view. Does that matter? Does it affect anything you said there?
So unfortunately, we didn't have time to look at that specifically. We had to narrow it down to more real basic one or two questions to begin with. I'm sure that does have an impact, but at the same time, when you go, say, and look at tomatoes in the pots and all the signs line up the tags that are in the pot, it all kind of blurs together, too. So having a big message on top might be a little more impactful in that instance.
Thank you.
Yep.
And I think you had a question, too.
So I was wondering if you mentioned that the people who like cats are also the people who tend to go to the garden. Is that information from Social Code?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. I'm on a short leash. Like a cat. I'd be no leash if I was a cat. At least what I saw, I can't confirm or deny anything, because some things, it's good that I don't have access to that Social Code data. You might ask Susan. She might have better access to Social Code data than me because of her working relationships with some big-time marketers. But what I can say is, from what I saw, yeah, cat enthusiast was pretty high. That's been one of the biggest revenue generators for Myriad Botanical Garden in Oklahoma City for the last several years. It's amazing. They put it on a huge screen. But it's also, they have some insight into income-based things as well. So it's not just interest level. It's also income generation-based in terms of they actually can tie some of the metadata to your credit score and your earning potential. So it's pretty interesting technology.
Well, Casey, I just wanted to ask, what the source of the information is for tying together cat lovers and gardeners. Do you have a source for that?
Yeah, so they tie together. God, I feel like this is really scary. Okay, so they tie together your credit report data from Experian. They tie together your purchase history data from large online retailers, as well as your location data. They don't tie it, or so they say, specifically to you. That's not their goal. Their goal is to weave all that together and paint a picture or paint a profile, at least say for a prospective business, of what your target demographic might also be interested in and what messages, like Jordan was saying, you might want to choose to resonate for. So, for example, if I, was trying to think about a plant that might engage millennials who also might be drawn to plants, I might decide that maybe I should grow more catmint, for example.
Susan.
So one of the creepiest things that we've learned, so if you Google social listening companies, there are many, many companies that do what Casey was talking about, and you pay for those services. And it does track you by your handle, if you're Instagramming, or if you're Twitter, or if you Snapchat. So it is a little bit creepy on a personal level. On a business level, if you're willing to pay, you can find out almost any bits of data. So just a little detail there. It's a little creepy. But yes, Google social listening companies.
The purpose was not to freak you out. The purpose was, how might you use this? Because in the next probably 5 years, people are going to, this is going to sort of just more mainstream.
Any other Pam?
I just have a comment, and I didn't realize, I'm loud enough, I didn't realize I was doing this, but we had a fundraiser back in March called Pints and Plants, and our whole goal was to get the millennials, our master gardeners needed to raise money, so we took it to the millennials. We sold out $2,000 worth of houseplants in no time, and they were just like crazy about all this, and they were asking. It was just like an eye-opener, and it didn't dawn on me until Jordan mentioned it was the experience that was the whole piece that I had not really thought about. So we're doing bourbon and bulbs and our beerito next year also. I mean, it's a whole new audience for our gardening now, so good stuff. That was just the local brewery.
I'm a little jealous because we're a dry campus. We can't do this.
Reporting was from the National Gardening Association, and that was before cannabis came up as a legalized product, right? So that would not be recorded if it was impacting things. No. I mean, in the next 5 to 10 years, then it might be interesting, but I don't know if it's fair to use age as a barrier there, say.
But they're still purchasing products like the soil and pots and grow lights and that kind of stuff. It would add to the statistics.
Well, should we go to what sort of take-home points? What are you going to take home today? What has inspired you? What are you going to implement? Okay, Instagram.
I'm texting away over here for Cultivate, our annual show, thinking, you know, how can we incorporate experiences into getting more intro to so.
Okay, incorporating experiences. Ellen, you want to say something, I can tell.
It just gives you promotional ideas that could be challenged by the university. Like, our arboretum is fine at your place, it's not fine there.
Yeah, but we did it at a local brewery.
It's true. It's true. But
your
know,
name is associated with it.
Yeah. You get thinking the possibilities are endless.
Just to riff off what Ellen was saying. So there's a popular thing that Sigma Xi has used for a while called Two Scientists Walk Into a Bar, and you'll pair with another scientist and you'll go to a bar and you'll answer scientific questions all night. So, two extension agents walk in a bar.
Love it. One brings a slide
carousel. Notice that everybody who's over 45 laughed.
I have no idea. So that was a Rodney Dangerfield moment for me.
I think for me, in thinking especially about the social media, is it kind of raised the bar. As far as the interaction level and the relationship that is necessary to create the platform. I'm as much trained in the older generation as anybody is, and you're just used to coming into a room, sharing information, and assuming that did the trick. And for me, it's like, oh boy, I think this just got harder.
That was exactly my thought. And once again, it comes down to the old gripe of administrative support for this kind of activity, too. So if you've got the world's greatest things happening on Instagram, it may not matter professionally.
Okay. We can't put it on our P&T packets, okay? Well, any examples of other millennial programming that you're doing that hasn't been mentioned here that has been a bright spot for you?
We had a real popular one in Ohio, Smart Grilling, and he worked with Weber as an ag agent, got a bunch of grills, and now he brings in the meat cuts, talks about the science behind grilling, the meat and all that good stuff, and they have a meal. It is hugely popular. I mean, he is going all over the state with this, not so popular, but it's that experience.
You know, maybe that's one thing we haven't discussed, is that we're talking about foodies. I mean, millennials are foodies, and maybe that's one way of bringing them in.
Yeah, and that's all the way to preparation.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. The beer we're serving is going to have maple and spruce tips.
Ooh.
And he's doing it just for the event, too.
Yes. So that would go along with like the edible portion of growing plants. So maybe an event could have, you know, you'd have six different spices or herbs that you could add onto it, and you could grill and show off different houseplants. So it would work out well, yeah.
The other thing, going back to cats, the other big question that came up at our houseplant event was, is this poisonous to cats? It was really, and all of our volunteers were looking these up, like, is it poisonous? And I never even thought about that. That was a big question for people.
Wow.
Yeah.
I worked at my horticulture club, and we also sold plants, and that, again, was one of the most frequent questions of anything. And it was, you know, beyond care, is this okay if my cat chews on it? Which I...
All right. So just to preserve it on the record when we go to write this up, is one of the most frequent questions is whether a certain plant is poisonous to your cat.
And I guess what I'm thinking in the big picture of some of the pet discussions and some of the foodie discussions is we tend to think traditionally of gardening as a distinct hobby and interest area. And what we're really seeing is the meshing of all of these different areas, right? You know, millennials are interested in their pets. How does that pair with their plants? They're foodies. How does that pair with their plants? And so we kind of have to step, it's a siloing issue, right? You know, we have to work with our colleagues, yeah, to, you know, bring in the vet school to talk about the toxicity issues, you know, those kinds of things.
So there's a nationwide program called Plant Night. Has anybody ever participated in a Plant Night? So do you remember the wine and canvas movement? So this is all plants. So it's been sort of the new movement with making succulent little terrariums. And so I've participated in a lot of them across the country. And the challenge and the criticism they're getting is the people who are hosting them are not able to answer questions about plants. So I was thinking maybe that's something that universities could pair up. It is called Plant Night, but I think the company now is called Yay Maker, Y-A-Y Maker. So I'm thinking maybe that's something that you as universities could look at in your own just communities and sort of volunteer to lob onto that and then maybe take it over, because that's been my experience, that they always have them, you know, kind of like wine and canvas, where you take home your really horrible painting, you get to take home your really cool terrarium. So I think that's maybe kind of something for us to look into. Yeah.
You're right.
I don't know. I've been doing something similar in North Dakota, and it's all because of the library. I have a couple master gardeners that are librarians. They're millennials, and they really get it. But they want to do horticulture programming through the library, so they had me come in and do a plant propagation night, and they filled up. So, I mean, we had the maximum number of people, and we were getting the millennial demographic. You know, and how many times do we, extension personnel, you know, get people in their 30s that come to our talk and have that be the majority of the audience? So I have to admit, one thing I'm going to do this winter is I'm going to update my plant propagation guide that NDSU has, and I'm going to update our houseplant publication, too.
Comment. Why was I missed the front end? Why was the library significant?
Why
did the millennials come there?
Well, our library system is so vibrant. I was really shocked at that. I mean, I don't know if this is nationally, but in Fargo, it's extremely vibrant because they're a lot like Extension in that, you know, they found that their market audience was dwindling, so they had to really invest in experiences. So they have really been innovative, and I'm learning from them. Now, it helps that two of my master gardeners are also librarians. They're very active. They started a seed library at the library, and then they also had other master gardeners that came in, and they did a youth horticulture day and such. But it's really interesting, this partnership that we have with the library, because they've been in some of the same situations as we have, and they're thriving now, at least in my community, because they are investing in experiences.
I would like to follow up on that, because in Orlando, there's this huge baby boom right now, and a lot of people are choosing not to go back to work. So they are looking for these outlets during the day that they can take their children to have social activities. And as such, I think the libraries are really benefiting because it's there, it's a public service, and it's a way that they can then interact and bring their children. And so I think that there's a opportunity there for us as well to kind of get in with that younger generation, the millennials who are having children, and then also work with their children to kind of make this a generational thing.
If you're going to update your two publications, consider the videos in YouTube. I just attended a workshop about a month ago with all of our extension professionals that are young, the millennials, and I mean, these kids are so good. Cell phone videos, you know, they're using Adobe and putting things together. And if you look at the astounding number of videos that are created daily and what they predict in the next 5 years, a fact sheet, a publication like that, they don't want. They want videos. So consider, I mean, I'm strongly looking at those thinking, why would I put a bulletin together when somebody wants a 30-second, 3-minute, you know, chunk of information?
Okay, I'm just going to put that on the record. Do YouTube videos instead of fact sheets.
Yep. Well, one of the things that, as I'm listening to all this, I'm thinking might be incredibly helpful to agents would be if we could aggregate all of these ideas and put together, you know, facilitator guidelines and naming stuff to set them up for success. But here's some things to try that are working well in different places, and I think that might be really helpful.
And we were talking
about
that.
You're hitting on exactly what we were talking about this afternoon when we were talking about this discussion. And Esther was saying, you know, we often think about reaching the audience that is our general public. But in many ways, some of our most important audiences may be working with our educators or our agents, either ones who are better at this already than we are, or ones who are not better than we are. Right, but, you know, coming up with toolkits, you know, across our systems to address some of these same things. And it goes back to the bigger administrative questions, too. If this is what's necessary and if this is what's applicable to our audiences, then how are we properly recognizing?
I just was going to comment on the literature thing. You know, I've stopped bringing it to meetings and things because nobody picks it up. And if you hand it out, they just leave it at the table. I mean, that's not the way people are talking now.
No, it's a website. Where can I get the information? Give you the website. And I mean, how many times have you looked up something, how to quickly fix something on your computer or what have you? It's going to be a YouTube video. I employ that all the time.
I think it gets back to people's learning styles and versus our methodologies, right? So too often I think we rely on the written word to try to do information transfer. And many of us are evaluated on it or see ourselves in our success on it. But the reality is that's only one way that people receive information. Some people are auditory learners, some people are visual learners, and some people are experiential learners. And so when you think about it, by just putting stuff out there in writing, we're only hitting one third of that capability. And so there's plenty of metrics that you can glean from social media about how many hits or how many things that you did, and then gaining that experiential part of it satisfies some of the traditional methodologies too. So just food for thought.
I think we've got like a minute or two, and then we don't want you to run off because we've got our business meeting. While you're here, join us.
For me, we're going to get together and produce a viral video, and we're going to feel really awesome about it. So if you walk out that door, you're not
going to
get to share that.
So you want me to go get the cats right now?
We've got a few right outside.
Victor and Roy will be coming. Yeah.
That is a thing. So I go to bar classes, and after every class, the instructor wants us to get together and do these little boom videos.
Wait, what,
I mean,
bar class?
It is. Oh, it's an exercise class, right? Oh, I wish it was a drinking class. You know, I'd be a professional at that, I think. But no, that's the thing, and that's how they're pushing it, and then they post it on social media immediately, and it's just the thing. It's in your hand, and it's immediate.
And there's one other thing we were discussing, I think, in some of our conference calls leading up to this, and that's how people anthropomorphize their plants. So they give their plants personalities. So they personify their plants. These are my babies. We're pregnant, like Jordan suggested. I mean, I don't know how to address that as an extension personnel that's supposed to be delivering facts and scientific objective information. So.
We're going to have to study it.
We have often kicked around occasionally at Mitch, you know, it's people love their plants. They keep investing in them long after they should have been dumped. I mean, I can't tell you how many poinsettias I've seen in September from the previous year with a half a leaf, and they're still trying, you know. It's misery.
And I think, as you know, most of us being trained as production people are coming kind of from that background. Like, I still don't get it. I mean, for goodness sakes, just buy a new poinsettia. But that's not, you know, the mindset, because it's there's that connection.
So maybe that's our next program, is we set up a grief counseling network for people with dead plants. You know, teach them to separate from their plants, how to let go, and it's okay to buy a new one.
Yes, yeah, we have reached the end of this time. Thank you very much for that great discussion. That was a lot of fun.